Hi, I'm Marcia Mormon, and I'm the author of The Darcys and the Bingleys. Today I'm going to be talking about my second book, The Plight of the Darcy Brothers. As with the last time, the first half of this podcast will be for people who have not read the book, or have read the book and want to hear me talk about it, but will be essentially spoiler free. Though I assume you've read the first book at this point. And the second part will be about my thoughts about the book with spoilers, discussing specific things about the book. So, how this book came to be. Obviously, I'd actually written, I was pretty far into the series in terms of writing it when I got the book deal for book one. I think I was around book seven or book eight in terms of actually writing. So, this was in the can for a very long time. And it was my first book that I wrote something novel length. I knew what novel length was. Novel length is about 80,000 words. And the first two stories that I wrote that became book one were not 80,000. You had to put them together before they were really a novel. And this was the first story that I did that was long enough to be its own book, way back before I thought I was going to publish it. But anyway, things came down the road, and after book one came out in 2008, it did very well. It wasn't a bestseller by any means, but it exceeded expectations and it earned its money back, which is very, very important in publishing. And Sourcebooks had what is called right of first refusal, which is in pretty much all contracts ever for book publishing. It's a standard clause that says that if you write one book and you sign the contract, there's a clause in it specifying that if you write the next book that you write and that you submit to be published, the original publisher has the first crack at it. They get to look at it before anyone else does. You can't shop it elsewhere. Obviously, this doesn't apply if you do something like you write a fiction book for a fiction publisher and then you go write a nonfiction book. You don't have to submit that. You can just tell them, by the way, I'm not submitting to you because you don't publish this. But, in this case, obviously, this prevents authors from hopscotching to different publishers for more money and gives a lot of stability to the publishing industry. And it also kind of ensures that the publisher has to look at the author's next book, even if they're going to eventually turn it down. So, they knew I had a whole series. They were very aware of it. And I sent in book two, along with summaries for all the other books. And there are three things that happen at that point, that could happen at that point. One of the three things is that the publisher says, yes, I want to buy your book. Here's how much money I want. Here's how much money I'm willing to give you. And at that point, you can say, that's not enough money. I'm walking away. But most people don't do that. Most people don't walk away from a solid offer, into the uncertainty of shopping your book elsewhere. That's a pretty dangerous thing to do in publishing. Most authors will just take the offer on the table. The second thing they can do, obviously, is say, no, we don't want your next book for whatever reason. We don't have to give a reason. And the third thing they can do is ask for more time, because the right of first refusal clause in the contract specifies the amount of time they have between when you submit the material and when they must give you an answer. And it's usually 30 days. For example, Book 4, which came out in May 2011, I submitted Book 5 in May 2011, not very long after the first after Book four had come out, and Ulysses, which is my current publisher, they had 30 days to look at book five. And after 30 days, they came back to me and they said, we need more time. Not because of the content of the book, but because we need more time to look at sales of book four and see how book four does. Can we please have, another 90 days? Or in this case, they didn't specify, they just said a couple of months. And my agent and I, we had no reason not to say yes, take your time, make the decision, because otherwise, the answer is going to be no. So that's what we're waiting on actually right now. Some people have asked me, when is book five coming out? We're still waiting to hear whether Ulysses Press wants to buy it from me. And it's been a couple months now, all of June, July, August. So hopefully they'll make a decision before the Jewish holidays at the end of September. So that's the status of book five, by the way. But with books two and three, I was really nervous. Obviously, I'm always nervous about publishing because it's a very unstable industry to be in. But the Sourcebooks was very, very kind and decided to buy two and three together in a bundle. And it's to their financial advantage to do that because generally they will have to pay less money per book in advance because as you go along in the series and become a more and more powerful author with a bigger following, you can demand larger advances. And if they buy the books early, in a bundle, they'll save money. But on the other hand, they have to put more books out. So they didn't buy the whole series, they bought two and three. So for book two, this is really crucial. I didn't realize how crucial this would be. For book two, I did not have to worry about the next book. I didn't have to worry that, I didn't have to worry about sales of book two in terms of whether book three would come out because book three was already, it was already, sold and was going to be published. This was the only time, and it's very rare that that a writer gets this kind of freedom is they don't have to worry about the book after the one they're working on. They don't have to worry about sales of their current book that they're working on because the next one is already in the bag. So I really enjoyed that. Really came to appreciate that, especially with after book one. I had no idea after book three, which I'll discuss when I discuss book three, exactly what happened there. I was very, very scared about sales. Obviously, I'm worried about sales of book four, which I have no control over. By the way, usually when you have a series, content is not the thing that determines whether the publisher buys your next book. The content of the book is not really an issue. The issue is, what did your last book do in sales? And if it did well, then they buy the next book. And if it didn't do well, then they don't buy the next book. So I don't think Ulysses is currently looking at book five. I don't think they're making a decision based on the content of book five. I know that they're making a decision based on sales of book four. So, it's really a, it's an industry that, at the bottom, the end of the day, the bottom line is you must sell copies of your book. Your book must sell well for other books of yours to be published. And I didn't have that worry for book two. And I knew I had a strong book going into it. I think of the first three, which are all published by Sourcebooks, that one is the strongest book in terms of being a book, having a plot arc that begins, builds, climaxes, and then concludes. Book one was really, it's really two stories. Book three has this massive, sprawling storyline in which characters are actually rescued midway through the book, but there's so much fallout from the events of the first half that there are different ways to, it takes a long time to resolve. Book one, book two really has that arc of a problem is introduced early in the book, and it takes the book, the rest of the book, for them to resolve it. And there's only, it's not swamped by plot lines. Later in the series, I just had so many characters that, I had a lot to do in each book. And in this particular book, I didn't have a tremendous amount on my plate, partially because I was a younger author and partially because a lot of characters weren't born yet or hadn't entered the picture yet. So there's only three main plot lines of this book. And, for people who haven't read the book, the first one is, I'm just going to give it away. It's not a huge spoiler. I think it's on the back of the book. I don't remember. Darcy and Elizabeth, Jane and Bingley, they're married. They're living in Derbyshire. And Mary Bennet, who has gone to seminary, which is a fin way of saying finishing school in France, comes home unexpectedly pregnant with from an Italian young Italian man that she was tutoring in Latin, who has now gone to Italy. And obviously, this is going to be a huge scandal if it gets out. So Darcy and Elizabeth decide to travel to Italy to track this guy down and either get him to pay out in cash or get him to marry her before the baby's born. The second main plot line, which comes up very quickly, not going to give a whole lot about it, but it is, you can't really talk about this book without talking about it, is that as Darcy's getting ready to leave for France in the very early chapters, his housekeeper, Mrs. Reynolds, reminds him that the Darcy family, which is originally from France many generations ago, still has some financial concerns in the north of France on the way to Italy, and maybe he should look into that. Maybe there's something he doesn't know. And he does look into it, and as the title of the book implies, he finds out that his dad had affairs out of marriage and had two children out of wedlock, one of whom he's known his entire life, and the other he meets in France. And is about Georgiana's age, a few months younger than Georgiana, who he has not known the existence of, and didn't know anything about this. And this is the beginning of, at this point, when I was writing the series for the first time, I didn't have a full scope of where I would eventually go with the Darcy family history, but I did want to shake Darcy's ground a little bit. In Pride and Prejudice, Darcy really, really looked up to his father. He speaks of him in very glowing terms. His father died when he was, I think, 22, so he had to take over Pemberley, and he became very stern, kind of as a result, maybe, of having all this responsibility and having to raise his sister at a, fairly young age. But he really, really respected his father, and I don't take away from that in that his father, his father, all the good qualities of his father are still there. His father was a good father to him. His father was a good father to Georgiana. His father was a good master of Pemberley. He was a good landlord. He was a respectful man. But he had some flaws that Darcy didn't know about when he was alive and doesn't really care to find out about, though it's sort of get, it's for, it's forced on him. But fortunately, he has Elizabeth around, and Elizabeth helps him out a lot with that. Now, the third plot line of the book, third main plot line of the book, there's some things going on in the background. Dr. Maddox and Caroline Bingley are the subject of that. Dr. Maddox has an encounter, a medical encounter with a patient who ends up connecting him to the royal family, and some he eventually becomes the royal physician to the Prince of Wales, who is going to be the Prince Regent but is not yet the Regent of England because his father is still somewhat sane and still ruling. And also, there's one major decision that they make that has that changes their family and has, is in every other book an important decision that they make that, really changes their lives. So, and there's other things going on. There's things going on with Bingley. He's not doing a whole lot. The book's not really about him. Sometimes characters, just they're not mentioned a whole lot. They fall into the background a little bit because the story's not on them at the moment. I don't always put them front and center if the story doesn't allow for it. And at the end of this book, as shown on the cover, it's a very nice cover for this book. I really do love the cover for this book in particular. There's a duel. And the result of this duel, and on the consequences of this duel, it is so important that it is mentioned in every single book, I think, after this. I could be wrong. I think maybe in book six there's no mention of it, but in some offhanded way it is mentioned in every single book after this one. It's a turning, it's not a turning point. Darcy doesn't become a different person, but in Darcy's life it is one of the crucial moments. And for a lot of other characters, some of whom are still very young, it doesn't color their lives, but it is in the back of their lives as this event that happened that we can't really undo, and we're not sure that we want to undo it, but it doesn't go well, and there's a death of a major Jane Austen character, which I hadn't previously done, and I don't do a whole lot. I don't go killing our characters off left and right unless I have to. And it's just a major point in the series, is that its scene is so significant, in that it's mentioned so many times in roundabout ways sometimes, or just outright ways. It's a point of contention for the children's generation. It's lurking in the background of a lot of things that happens to the children. It's just a very important scene, and when you get to it, you'll know why it's a very important scene. But it's a crucial scene, and I'm really glad I did it. I was a little concerned about killing off a Jane Austen character, but in the end, I thought that it was definitely the right thing to do. And I was very happy with how this book came out. Anyway, so that's pretty much my general feelings on book two, which is called The Plight of the Darcy Brothers. So I hope that you will check it out. If you haven't checked out the first book, you can start with the second book. I don't really recommend it, but you can definitely do it. I mean, you can kind of figure out what happened in the first one. After book two and book three, you really can't do that. You need to go back and read the other books. Too much has happened. But book two, you can kind of start off. But I recommend reading book one first, obviously. But if you're listening to this podcast, you've never read the book, I hope you enjoy it. However you come about it, whether you read it online or you download it or you get it on your Kindle or you get the actual book, which, I prefer to read them in actual books. I'm very old-fashioned that way. Despite being someone who sits in front of her computer all day, I really don't like reading books on my screen. And I don't like reading them on my Kindle, and I don't like reading them on my Sony e-reader. I don't like reading them on my iPhone. I like reading actual books. Just wanted to throw that in. So, however you come about it, I hope that you enjoy it. Anyway, thanks for listening. Part two. For people who have read the book, I'm not going to go over all the plot points. I'm just going to continue with what I have to say about this book. So I did a ton of research when I had to go back and edit this book, and that research all revolved around Gregoire living in a monastery. In the original version of the book, I sort of hedged my bets and said that while most of the monasteries had been dissolved in the French Revolution in 1789, there still were a couple around in very remote areas, and Gregoire grew up in one of those. And I had a sense that this might not be true. And when it came time for publication, I obviously had to, cross all my T's and dot all my I's. So I did a tremendous amount of research about monasticism during and post-French Revolution. We're now in a time period. This book takes place in 1807. Napoleon is ruling France. He's going to rule France, for another 12 years. He's going to rule France until 1812, and then he's going to rule it again in 1815. A lot is going on in France, and there are no monasteries at all. They were all dissolved during the French Revolution. There were many of them, and they were all dissolved, and everyone sent, somewhere else. So I had a problem, and I thought about moving Gregoire outside of France, but at this point, most of the other areas near France, where I might have been able to put him, had also dissolved their monasteries because Napoleon, when he conquered Western Europe, he dissolved monasteries as he went along. So I didn't really have much to work with. And then I found out that there was a brief period where some Cistercians, and which is the order that Gregoire belongs to and originally belonged to, and some Jesuits managed to convince Napoleon to let them operate in France again after they had been banned from France for at least 10 years. And he said yes. And there was a brief period in this exactly over this time, fortunately, when there were some things operating that, monastic houses in some sort of condition. Fortunately, I was able to kind of finagle the existence of this small monastic house, which I greatly reduced the size and wealth and amount of monks, in, so it could exist for this brief period. It didn't last. I mentioned that in later books. The Napoleon eventually went back on his promise. He was very temperamental, particularly about religion. And the monastery that didn't exist stopped existing. In real life, he actually expelled the monks and the brotherhood. What is it called? The Society of Jesus is the name for the Jesuits. He eventually expelled them again towards the end of his reign. He's a very moody guy. You really couldn't tell what he was going to do next. So that's how I managed to kind of finagle that so that plot line could still exist. I did eventually end up moving Gregoire from Germany to Austria because I found out there weren't any monasteries that I could really work with in Germany for book three, so there were some changes there. But I went to obscure journals to try and find history of the Cistercians during the Revolution to, try and make this plot line work. And I think that, no one has complained about it so far. People have complained about other things, but they haven't complained about this. There haven't been a lot of complaints about book two. It's not a very contentious book. It doesn't bring up, despite Darcy having two half brothers, one of whom is Wickham. Some people have said, oh, that's gross because he almost slept with Georgiana, which is kind of gross. Some people noticed it had been done before, and it has been done before, actually. Wickham has been the half brother of Darcy in a lot of fan fiction and in Linda Birdall's Mr. Darcy Takes a Wife, though Wickham never figures it out. But Darcy does. And that was a major plot line of that book. And I really liked that plot line and I wanted to do it, but I wanted to do it differently. And the way that I did it differently was I killed off Wickham very, very quickly. Not because I didn't like him, but just sort of, I don't remember particularly what I was thinking when I wrote it. I just wrote it as I felt it would go. And I didn't really have much to do with Wickham beyond that point, And I had a lot more to do with Lydia, who I don't really do much with in the series, but and I eventually end up doing a tremendous amount with his son George, who I had to give everybody the same names just to make it fun. So that was what I did for Gregoire. That was just a lot of background research just to make a plot line that I had written in and couldn't unwrite and didn't really want to unwrite. I really wanted it to go the way that it went. Just to make that happen. Some of the other things that were changed were standard things that were changed. The amount of money that Mary received was reduced to something reasonable because I realized I had given her too much money. And some things were changed with the dialogue. I don't think anything was changed with the plot line with the Prince of Wales. There's nothing really to change there. Prince of Wales, he didn't sleep around. He did sleep with a number of different women who weren't his wife. He probably only slept with his wife once. And he was married to another woman, Maria, who he had several daughters with. I don't think he had any sons, but he did have several daughters with her. And this was pretty well known. And there are several people who had claim, not on the throne, because you have to be a legitimate heir to be an heir to the throne. So there was never any ever going to be any plot line about Frederick trying to inherit the throne. There was no chance of that. And you had to be from the royal marriage to apply for the throne, even if there was like some math King Ralph type death. You wouldn't be eligible if you were born out of wedlock. Just because you were the son of the current prince or the current king, as eventually will happen. Eventually he'll be King George IV. He did have a number of what we suspect are sons with other women, though he was actually pretty consistently monogamous with his wife Maria, the non-acknowledged wife, the wife who was Catholic and therefore the marriage was considered null and void because there's a law in Britain that a member of the royal family cannot marry a Catholic. So even though he married her first before he married Queen Caroline, of Brunswick, I think it is. Which I always think of New Brunswick in New Jersey when I hear that. Even though he married Maria first, the marriage never counted, but he was loyal to her. But they had periods where they were on and off. Like there were periods where they were living together as a couple and basically married and acting like they were married. And there were periods where they were more estranged, and there were periods where they were just plain falling out. But she really was the love of his life. But he did sleep with other people. And obviously he didn't sleep with the imaginary prostitute that I came up with for this story. But he did, at least in theory, but never acknowledged, have at least two sons with other people before he died. I think both of which were named George. So everyone was named George in this time period. And also probably after their father, George. Frederick is named after his father's middle name, Frederick. So that wasn't a plot line I needed to do anything with. And there wasn't a whole lot else to change. Oh, there was one other major thing to change, and I'm really proud of this. In the original version of the story, Darcy has his kidney removed. And I eventually decided, after a lot of medical research, that this was not possible in that time period. Just no one had the technical expertise to do it. Not even Dr. Maddox. He's not a miracle worker. So I eventually cut this down to inflammation of the kidney, of which you can still die of, but is something that will go away eventually on its own, if you're lucky. Inflammation is something that flares up and then slowly retreats if the thing that caused it to flare is removed. And what Dr. Maddox does treat him with, I got from a medical book that I bought on eBay from 1820 Philadelphia, which is a bit later than our time period, but that was the best I can do. It's this massive compendium of cures for every single thing that could possibly come up, and they're all pretty bad. Usually in the cures, there's like three ingredients, one of which does nothing. It's a non-ingredient. One actually kind of treats the problem in a very poor manner, and one actually just harms you and possibly kills you. So you were really better off not taking any medicine at this time period. But sometimes they had medicines that had medicinal properties, but they didn't really know why. For example, in book 3, Gregoire makes Lady Catherine drink willow bark tea. He doesn't know this, but the reason that willow bark tea saves her during a heart attack is because willow bark contains small traces of aspirin. And if you chop up enough of it, you will get aspirin. It's just a very inefficient method of getting aspirin if you can buy it in a store, but obviously they couldn't buy it in a store. But they didn't know this. They just knew that willow bark tea was good for people who had heart attacks. They just didn't always know why something worked. They just knew from experience that it did work, and then they put it together with other ingredients, which often negated whatever good the initial ingredient did. And there's actually a lot of other cases, because I had this book, there's a lot of other cases of people using medicines in the later books, particularly to prevent pregnancies and getting really, really sick from them because they don't work and they make you much worse than if you hadn't taken them at all. Or they do work, but they also kill you. So, there that's a major problem, I think, with a medication if it is also deadly. So I was really proud of that. Someone did say, I don't know if Dr. Maddox could have done this in a review, and I just was like gloating inside, like, haha, no, he could have. You know why? Because I did a ton of research on this. I really know my shit for this particular area, and I'm right. I don't have to prove it to you, I just am, and I'm really proud of what I did in that case. So I think that's basically what I have to say about book 2. I'm gonna have a lot to say about book 3. But I spent a lot of the editing for book 2 worrying about what was gonna come for book 3, because I knew that editing wise it was gonna be a major deal, and it was actually a much more major deal than I even imagined. But so I really didn't worry that much about book two. Source books didn't have much to change in it, didn't really request much of me, and they didn't know it was coming with book three either, which is part of the story of book three, is not having read it ahead of time before they bought it, which, led to problems down the road. But we eventually worked everything out and the book got published and I'm very happy with it. But that was my main concern as I was doing this book because I knew I only had like a couple months break between editing this book and editing book three. And I think there was actually some crossover between me approving layouts of book two, which was an easy book to edit, in edit with the copy editor and all that, and edit with the editor at Source Books. That was an easy book, and then beginning the experience that was trying to publish book three. So next time I'll talk about that. I'm not going to say anything bad about anybody at Source Books. I'm still a I still publish with them. They still do a great job of promoting my first three books. I'm really happy about the experience I had with them. But it was an editorial struggle on both sides. We both wanted what was best for the reader, but we had, very different opinions of what that was. So that's for next time. Thanks for tuning in. I hope that you're enjoying these. And I hope that you enjoyed book three. And if you're still listening but you haven't read the book three, then you're probably a little confused because I referred to things and didn't explain what the references were. You should probably go read book three now. I mean, book two. You should probably go read book two now. Oh my God, just used the wrong number. Oh, by the way, while I'm here, the reason that I used numbers is because the books all got retitled for publication. They didn't need titles that referenced Pride and Prejudice when they were being posted on fanfiction.net because you were in the Pride and Prejudice section, so you knew what you were getting. But I had to somehow work Pride and Prejudice or Darcy into the title of every book, and I really despised doing that, even though it was the right thing to do. I just am very bad at titling things. It's not my strength. And so I don't always totally 100% remember what I titled the various books. I mean, it'll come to me, but it'll take a second. So I just refer to them, in number form. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And it's just easier for me, and it's easier for the people I work with to not have to say the whole title and remember which how I titled which book. In some cases, friends of mine are like, wait, which one was book two? Was it the Plight book or was it the Brothers book or are they the same book? And I'm just like, okay, it was the Plight of the Darcy Brothers, book two, Mr. Darcy's Great Escape, book three, Battle of Gregor Darcy, book four. Now, I do actually know the titles. It's easier for me to use the numbers. So that's what I do. I just use the numbers when I'm talking about the books as a series or talking about them individually. That's just what I've fallen into doing, and I don't think I'm really going to stop. So, kind of get used to it. Anyway, next time I will be talking about book three, A Mr. Darcy's Great Escape, which is not really a criminal caper, but I do like the title as it came out. It does kind of sound kind of funny. It's not a very funny escape, but well, I think it's a funny escape, but Anyway, I'll talk about that next time, so stay tuned.